welcome back to Screen of Consciousness, a podversation about the film and TV shows that we love. Now, before we start, I'd just like to ask you to please subscribe. You can find us on Spotify, on Apple, on Google Podcasts. We're all over the place. So please subscribe if you love our show, which I'm sure you do. And you can also find us on Twitter at Screen of C and on Facebook and Instagram at SFC Podcast. Now, this week, we're going to talk about location is everything, as the title suggests, because we've mentioned multiple times in some of our other episodes about how important locations are, haven't we, Dimitri?
Indeed we have, and I think for everyone who loves film or TV or both, even if you hadn't considered that, your favorite film or TV show, I'm sure, has some memorable location that is not just interesting in itself, but also well-presented. It's used well by the filmmakers, and that, I think, will be our focus today, won't it? How you use a location.
Yes, exactly, because we talked in our James Bond episode about how important those locations are in James Bond, because, of course, we get to see these kind of beautiful locations from around the world. And, you know, back in the 50s, most people weren't really travelling that much, so it was really important to see them. But I think location, I think the way I see location, really, Dimitri, and I don't know about you, is that from a narrative point of view, location can really, really help the story as well as the visuals, and also sometimes locations can actually be a character in their own right. So I think that's really kind of the focus now of what we're going to discuss, isn't it, really, about how important those locations are in a film to the actual story and character.
Yes, the narrative part played by locations, which in some, especially films and TV shows, is completely central to the plot, to the character development, and to say nothing of the atmosphere, which is really in many films primarily created by the location.
Yes,
I would say before we start that we will kind of split it down into three subcategories, as it were, because there are cities. Many, many films are set in cities, and cities play a big part in the story. Then there are sets. Of course, all films, almost all films have sets, but some films are primarily filmed in sets, and also some stories mean that the sets are quite restrictive. Just to give you one example, we will be talking about this later, films set on a submarine. You can imagine, I'm sure everyone has seen at least one submarine film. That's the whole location, isn't it? Sort of tube where our poor characters are trapped. And then finally, obviously, we will talk about nature, which maybe for some is the kind of most, the first thing you think of when you hear the word location. It's some beautiful nature, some scary nature, some exotic nature. So these are cities, sets, and nature. All can serve as locations, and all can be very efficient.
I think it's a good way to talk about it because, you know, you mentioned it and I thought it was a smart way to do it. So, and I think...
Thank you. I have my moments.
It's good because I think, okay, we're going to talk about cities first, of course, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're excluding towns or small locations. Mm. I think that cities, generally, the reason we want to talk about them is because cities are iconic. And just to start off, I think, you know, one of the most earliest films ever made that has the most iconic moments in a city is, of course, King Kong. Because, you know, although the whole film is not set in New York City, most of the film isn't set in New York City. Obviously, the ending when King Kong climbs the Empire State Building, you know, that is one of the most iconic images ever in film history.
Yes.
Now, I know that I wouldn't say that the New York City is a big character in the film because it's not where most of the film's set on an island. But it just shows you that ever since the beginning of cinema, those cities and those locations have always been so important because, you know, obviously they chose for him to climb up the Empire State Building for a reason because, you know, it's such a recognizable landmark in New York. We know exactly where King Kong is because of the building he's climbing up. And I think ever since then, they've always had these, you know, in America, let's talk about Hollywood films.
I would slightly disagree with you. I think that the city is a character. I think it is an antagonist. Because, you know, King Kong taken out of his natural habitat and put into this city. I think that's sort of an allegory, I guess, or maybe it's more of a metaphor. The city represents humanity, isn't it? And it's kind of a film about, like, I think humanity versus nature. And, you know, he's taken, because humans go to King Kong's natural habitat and it's kind of wild for them, right? But yes, then they take King Kong back to their natural habitat and it's just as wild for him and it's very hostile. And I even think there's something of this, I think it's very tragic. It, you know, he climbs to the highest point. I'm no expert on gorillas, but I could imagine that could be some kind of natural reflex for a big ape, you know, to climb his way out of danger. But, you know, the humans also have planes and they murder him. I mean, I think there's, if you're willing to kind of do a psychological analysis, I'm sure a lot of people have done with this fantastic film and this scene. I think there's a lot of things, not to say nothing of the phallic symbol that obviously is, you know, the new Empire State Building.
That's true. Also, but they do say the woman's the one who kills him at the end, the final line. It's beauty that killed the beast, right? So maybe this. But no, okay, I accept what you're saying. I think the way I see it then is I agree with you. I don't think you're wrong. I think the way that we now would do a city is very different. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it is important that that film is set at the ending in New York City, and that is an important part of it. But I guess the way I see it, so let's move forward in time. You know, let's talk about Italian neorealism. Now, a lot of you might not be familiar with this, but during the kind of late 40s, early 50s, in Italy, there was a lot of films that were made that were kind of done in a realistic style, which was called Italian neorealism. And it meant that the plots kind of, they didn't really have scripts or plots. A lot of the actors were not real actors, and they used real locations. So I think what's really important about these films is that they look real, and they were at the time occupied by Nazis. So for example, a film called Rome Open City was filmed during the Nazi occupation of Rome. And I think what's so interesting about this film is, you know, it looks like a documentary. It's not a documentary, but it looks like one because, you know, we get to see the real Rome streets. Now, I think most people probably think of Rome in a film like La Dolce Vita, which is obviously a very beautiful, stylized Rome, even though that film itself actually does show kind of horrible housing estates and some gritty parts of Rome too. I think most of us just think of the scene where one of the women kind of walks into the Trevi Fountain and it's all very beautiful and glamorous. But, you know, what I like about the Italian neorealism is that they show the real to those Italian cities, and they make you feel like they're not just so glamorous and beautiful. Because I think, you know, nowadays when we show cities, especially Los Angeles, they're always looking perfect, beautiful,
yeah,
very stylized. And I don't know if you've ever been to Los Angeles, Dimitri. I don't think you have.
No.
But Los Angeles is not beautiful. It does not look anything like how it looks on film. I mean, I've been there, and trust me when I say it does not look very pretty. There are parts of it that are pretty, of course, and some very nice buildings, but most of it does not look the way it looks on film.
Well,
and
the people making those films, though, I'm sure they live in the nice pretty parts.
Yeah, in the Hollywood Hills. But even Hollywood Hills and all of the kind of posh parts aren't as nice looking as you think that they will be, which is interesting.
Can I just also point out that, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're much more knowledgeable about Italian neorealism than I am, but wouldn't this, I'm sure this, you know, of course, was a reaction to the World War II and, you know, fascism in Italy. But also, in terms of purely cinematic terms, wasn't this a reaction as well to Hollywood, which back then was almost exclusively filmed in studios? Hollywood kind of didn't start filming out in nature, even out in cities, I think, until the late 60s or something. So Hollywood, at that point, Hollywood films were very much kind of controlled, and they were filmed in sets, and it was, well, obviously it was stylized because you made the sets look the way you wanted them to.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, that was a big breakthrough compared to American cinema, right? What happened in Italy, where you took it out of studios and started filming, as you say, you know, on the streets, and the streets looked the way they did.
Yes, and also talking about narrative, you know, a film like The Bicycle Thieves, which is very, very popular in people who are, you know, like film theory and, you know, more film buffs. The Bicycle Thieves, of course, has a very important point to it, as does Rome Open City and a lot of the other ones. And it's all about the poverty and about the kind of social issues that were taking place in Italy at the time. And when you think that they were filming it at the time that was actually happening with people who were experiencing that themselves, as I said, they weren't necessarily all actors, it just gives this very real a documentary feel. It feels mm-hmm. genuine. It feels very real. And you're right, comparing that to the Hollywood films at the time, where they were built on massive sets, you know, when you think of the huge, amazing sets that they were building in some of the films, it's just completely different contrast. And it's funny, because I think you're right, that that's then completely influenced Hollywood. Because, I mean, I want to talk about a TV. So TV, like, obviously lots of films are set in places, but I think now TV can do more with these locations, because of course TV series go on for longer, you know, you get more time with them, you get more time with the sets and the locations and the characters, whereas, you know, a film is usually 2 hours long or less or more, whereas a TV show can really develop those cities up more. There's one TV show I wanted to talk about, which is set in LA, you know, going back to how LA looks, which is called Southland. Now, I don't know if you've heard of Southland. It wasn't particularly popular or famous, but it was very kind of critically acclaimed. I loved it when it was on TV. It was a great show. And it's all set in Los Angeles. It's all about police working in Los Angeles. But what's interesting about this show is that it shows all different sections of society. So it shows the kind of gritty poverty, but it also shows the very rich, you know, elite people who live in LA as well, because the police have to deal with both sides of those spectrums. And they did film in real locations, but they don't make it look glossy. They make it look how it looks in real life. It looks very genuine, very real. You can see real people walking down the streets in the background. And what I love about this show is not only does it look real, the situations they have, you know, you normally think of cop shows, you know, being like lots of shooting and lots of kind of over the top police chases. But in this show, they don't do it like that. They do it in an Italian neorealistic style, where, for example, sometimes one plot there's lots of different characters in the show, but one subplot could be, you know, a woman, like her cat stuck in a tree or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you just see it. And it's, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the episode. And it's just very real. It doesn't seem like you'd want to watch that. But the way the show is done, it's just really genuine and believable. I think this show is such a great show. And it does make LA look real, if that makes sense. Which I was going
to
say.
In relation to that, just we should name check The Wire also, which did some of the things that you're describing here, only with Baltimore. And I think also must have been one of the first TV shows to go kind of that deep and that broadly into a city, because it does also show from the sort of, you know, the poor areas which are primarily African-American to the Docklands, you know, with a lot of poles, and of course also, you know, the kind of center of the city where you have the politicians and the police commissioner. I think that's also interesting. I think it, especially when you go to the docks, which, you know, as I said, like, it's a lot of Polish immigrants who have historically worked there. There are some parallels in The Wire between, you know, sort of the exterior of the city and the nationality or the culture that's sort of dominant in this area.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think as well, Bosch is another show set in LA, which is another police procedural show, which also shows it. But I think it shows the more glossy side of LA, which is quite interesting. And talking about shows that set in cities, I would say negatively, I mean, one of the shows I love called Dexter, I would never ever want to go to Miami, because I think they make Miami look like such a horrible hellhole. Because I just think the whole point of Dexter is about a serial killer who kills serial killers. So for me, you know, I've never been to Miami in my life. It could be a lovely place, but because it's all about serial killers murdering innocent people, I'm just terrified to go to Miami. You know, because it just looks scary. They make the city of Miami look terrifying. And, you know, when you think of a film like Scarface, they also make Miami look very scary there in that film. And, you know, CSI, of course, the famous TV show CSI, they also had a spin-off called CSI Miami. And once again, everyone's getting murdered. So to me, I just think of Miami as being like murder capital of America, which I'm sure it isn't. And I think that shows how important.
That honors goes to Chicago. By the way, I just want to mention also, because with you together back at film school, we watched the first season of Dexter, which I did like a lot. And I want to say, I feel like, I don't think it's Southern Gothic at all, but it's interesting. It kind of made me think of that, because it's, I think there's a challenge in making a place that's so warm and sunny, so scary. Yes. You know what I think?
Yes.
Because, you know, the London with Jack the Ripper, well, it's kind of foggy and dark all the time.
Yep.
It's not difficult to be a serial killer, you know?
Yes.
Whereas in Miami, it's like broad daylight, the sun is out, and there's like hot girls and hot boys partying all the time for spring break or whatever. And still, I do think, yes, Dexter has this lovely creepiness where they kind of play off. I think that's part of the creepiness, isn't it? That it's meant to be this happy place in terms of climate and, you know, people going there to enjoy themselves, and yet there's all this violence taking place.
Yes, no, 100%. You're right, actually. That's a really good point. I think the fact that, you know, the famous Miami Strip is all kind of neon lights works really well, because a lot of the time Dexter's driving down the strip, and of course, as you said, it's not Southern Gothic. It's more noir, I would say, like, you know, film noir.
Oh, interesting.
With the kind of darkness and the lights, the neon, you know, it looks very dark. As you said, and it's not a dark place. It's not, you know, it's not like Norway, which has, like, you know, 6 months of darkness or something. You know, it's actually a very bright, vibrant place, but it make it look very scary. And I think this is where, as we're saying, this is where location can be so important. And, you know, cinematography and the script and the acting, everything kind of goes together with the location to make it a personality. And also, I'd just like to mention another TV show that's not American or English speaking, which is called Braquo. I don't know if you've ever heard or seen this show, but oh my gosh, it's such a good show. It's French, it's set in Paris, and wow, does it make Paris look like a hellhole. I mean, seriously, and I've been to Paris, and Paris is pretty dodgy in parts, just like London is. But they really make Paris look awful, and it's just, but it seems so believable. Like the way that they make it, they don't make it look terrible in a kind of over the top fake way. They make it look terrible in a, I believe that this is what happens in Paris way. I mean, it's all about police once again, investigating criminals and crime, but they just make Paris look very grimy, and Paris is definitely a character in that show, because, you know, the characters are Parisian and they speak with Parisian accents, which, I mean, I don't understand what they're saying. Like, I mean, I can't speak French, but obviously I did some French in school and I don't know what they're talking about. They have very thick accents, which I think really helps the show as well, kind of make it feel really believable. So yeah,
obviously Paris is a city that has been used in so many films, in lots of American films, and of course in lots of French films as well. And I think it is usually, yes, it's very different to how to describe. Usually it's kind of romantic, sunlit, you know, with like little cafes with people sitting outside.
Yeah.
And I think Paris has, you know, I think Paris has been well served by cinema. Unlike London.
Yes.
And that, I think, was one of the plural of impetus. one of the impeti for this episode was something we've talked about, and how London has almost never been shown really well in films, especially modern London.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we talked about The Gentleman in our episode, you know, our episode, the
Look Back at 2020, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, we talked about The Gentleman in our Look Back at 2020 episode. And, you know, yes, some of it's filmed in London. It just doesn't look to me like London. It doesn't look real. I think the only films I could really think of where I think London really feels like a character and seems genuine, one of them is Frenzy, which we talked about before in our first episode, I think, of our pilot episode. And Frenzy obviously was filmed in the 70s. It's a Hitchcock film. And it's mainly filmed around Covent Garden, which of course looks nothing like how it looks in the film now. But it just seems very genuine then. Like the way it looks, it seems very believable. All the houses, all the kind of locations look real. And one of the other films I was thinking of, which is really weird, was The World Is Not Enough, which is a James Bond film. Because the very beginning has Pierce Brosnan's James Bond jumping out of the MI6 building and driving down the Thames in a boat, and kind of as he drives down the Thames, he's kind of driving past various landmarks and locations, and I actually do think that those locations look fairly real. And I think the reason why it looks real is because he's in the river and it's raining a little bit, I think, and it looks really grimy and kind of brown. And I think, yeah, that is what London looks like in real life. You know, it doesn't look all beautiful and glossy where you see it now. Like, if you think of a modern James Bond, you know, when they cut to London for like 5 minutes, it's always so glossy. They're always standing on top of a tall building and showing skyscrapers and stuff. And to me, okay, yeah, of course those skyscrapers exist, they're there, but that's not how London looks or feels to me. And I'm a Londoner.
So, So Skyfall has quite a lot of London. I know what you mean about the kind of cutting to it, but Skyfall, a lot of that is set in London, isn't it? But yes. That doesn't work for you then.
Well, no, because, okay, for example, I mean, I can't really remember it. I remember, I think he does stand on top of a building at the end, you know, there's like a nice view of London. And I remember, yeah, he's on the tube, I think, right? And
yeah, so then the tube trains keep crashing into each other.
Exactly.
Somehow you can do that with a tube, apparently.
It's too glossy for me. I mean, even when you think of films like Harry Potter, which are set, have moments in London, it just looks glossy. I just remembered, actually, there's a horror film called Creep. Which is set all on the London Tube, on the London Underground, and it's about a kind of cannibalistic mutant that eats people. And actually, I do remember that film looks very realistic because the tube that they film it on, the tube station, looks gritty and horrible and unclean. And, you know, I think that film's quite realistic. I mean, obviously, hopefully not the cannibalistic murderer.
But the tube is disgusting. You know, as a proud denizen of St. Petersburg, which has a fantastic underground system, which you know, all the tourists come to photograph. Yeah, you're not going to photograph the tube because it's pretty nasty. And it is interesting. And I lived in London for 2 years. I love London, but yeah, the tube isn't. It's very efficient. Well, sometimes it often does not run. I remember at least some
depends
lines.
Depends what line. Yeah,
but. It's, yes, London, I feel like, either it's shown basically as if it were L.A. or New York. Skyscrapers, a lot, you know, there's always glass. I think even I wanted to say that when you talk about L.A., it's always like clean, glittering glass.
Yes.
It's like, well, glass isn't always clean. But also, it's that, or when you said about Harry Potter, that's interesting, then it's kind of very cutesy and quaint, isn't it? Like, oh, ye olden London.
Yes.
And it doesn't, unfortunately, I'm a conservative, I love old things, but London doesn't really look that quaint anymore, I think.
No, even when you go to the old parts, you know, like East London, where there's all cobbled streets and stuff, it just doesn't look like that very much anymore. And I just think, yeah, it kind of annoys me that people haven't, no one I don't think has really made a very good version of London, modern London, that really looks and feels how it does in real life. Maybe we will do that one day, Dimitri. Who knows?
Why not? Someone should. Because I was about to say, it's not for lack of trying. Like, I guess half of British films and TV shows are set in London. We talked about, you know, the Sherlock with Cumberbatch and Freeman. I don't think that looks real at all. I think that's probably on the glossy side, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely.
Very high-techy. And, like, London isn't that high-techy, which I think is part of its charm.
Yeah. I guess maybe the reason why, because, you know, we talked about L.A., and obviously we didn't really talk about New York, but of course, we did a little bit about King Kong, but maybe the reason why, you know, of course, the weather in those locations is better. Maybe the reason why London just doesn't have, and maybe, I mean, I know Paris does, but let's just talk about London then. Maybe the reason London doesn't look like that is just because you can't film it consistently. But then maybe that's the reason why we should show it like that. You know, we should show it raining a lot of the time and it being grey and it being overcast and it being kind of miserable and also being sunny and bright because that is what it's like to live in London. But they just don't show it like that. They are, as you said, they have show it glossy, clear sky, sunny. Or they show it kind of seedy, dark, foggy. But you don't really get that temperamental mix of the weather, which is actually what is realistic to London.
And that because St. Petersburg has similarly temperamental weather, although it is colder in general. But I also think, yes, that the changes in weather really change how buildings look as well. I think everyone knows that living in a place like London or St. Petersburg. It's they can look much more menacing and cold when it's grey and kind of brighter and sort of nicer when it's sunny, obviously. Mm. And I definitely think there's ways of catching that, but it's as if it's not being done. Because also I think, you know, instead of filming something like St. Paul's with all this, you know, all the atmosphere of that, you just do film the same skyscrapers over and over again.
Mm. But I guess the thing is with something like St. Paul's is, the reality of St. Paul's, if you're a tourist and you've never been to London before, you would just be walking down the street and you might see St. Paul's. It's not in a specific location. It is in a specific location. What I mean, though, is you could be walking from one place to another and suddenly St. Paul's is there.
Yeah. You've crowded your historical buildings. I think that's a travesty, because this is in St. Petersburg. We've been very strict of, you know, there's a big square in front of every cathedral, so that, yes, you do have, you're right, it's hard to film. But again, that could be a way of filming it, or you could film it closer.
Yeah, I feel like that's how you could show it, you know. But anyway, I feel like we've given a lot of time to cities. We're meant to do three more bits.
We are city boys, but yes, let's rush onward.
So moving on to the sets. So with sets, I think what we mean is locations that have been created in the studio. So they're all not real. They're not real locations. It's not like we've actually gone and got a real submarine to film on a submarine. It's like we've built that submarine in a studio. But we're talking about locations that are successful, because, you know, some studio locations look really terrible, and some of them look really, really good. Now, I've talked about Dark City multiple times before, but this is a film that is entirely set in a studio. It's all filmed in a studio, but they created a city. You know, it looks like and feels like a real city. It's a believable city that they've created. And I think that's what's so hard to do sometimes. And that's why I think, you know, Dark City is a great example of that. I mean, going to a more extreme, I want to talk about a film called Cube, which is a Canadian horror film from the late 90s. And Cube is literally set in one room, which is a square room. And they film it multiple times from multiple angles, but they've essentially built one set. But it shows you how you can create a feeling and an atmosphere and a character in just one room if you know how to do it properly. And I think Cube does do that properly.
And I think of the submarine films, I mean, certainly we could mention Crimson Tide, that we've talked about recently in our 90s action episode. Das Boot, I think, is the classic, maybe the first submarine film, at least of the kind of big and serious works. It's from 1984, I think. So definitely a 1980s German film about a German submarine during World War II, where that's really where it's used to full effect, directed by Jordan Peterson, Wolfgang Peterson.
Yes.
Very, very well directed. And the oppressive feeling of, you know, being stuck in that submarine. And also there's quite early in the film, you get this idea that they're sort of headed for disaster because they have a very difficult mission, which I think is a fairly obvious, but, you know, nonetheless efficient metaphor for that of, you know, just Germany's fate towards the end of World War II. That is very, very, very powerful.
And I'd like to mention a film called Below, which I think came out in the late 90s, early noughties, which I think is actually a British film. I'm not sure, but it's a horror film anyway. And it's all, once again, set on a submarine. And, you know, Das Boot and Crimson Tide obviously are more thrillers, and they're kind of, they use the submarine space for kind of tension, and Below does as well, but it does it for a horror effect. So it does it very, it's very dark, and, you know, there's shadows and things moving you can't quite see. And I think a submarine is a perfect location for a horror film when you think about it, because you're trapped on a tube under the water, and in that film there's a ghost kind of haunting them, which I really like this film. I think it's very effective, but once again, the whole point is that the submarine is the personality, really, or big part of the film. You know, it's the whole point of the film, that you're creating this tension. The way the actors, you know, behave, it's affecting them, and it's also affecting the lighting, you know, and all of the stuff that happens in the film is really influenced by that set. So I think it's just really important, you know, that they do it really well, and I think this is a film where they have done it well.
In terms of the creepy atmosphere, we have to mention, I think, one of the best, most famous, classic examples of sort of set-driven films, especially in kind of the horror and science fiction genres, which is Alien.
Yes, of course.
I mean, Alien, the original Alien, directed by Ridley Scott from 1979, is... we see some of the alien planet, of course, that was a set as well, and a beautiful one. But the whole second part of the film, maybe even more than the second half, is just set on the spaceship, mm-hmm. where, you know, an alien gets loose. We won't spoil it too much, but I think that's that much we can say. And the crew has to deal with it. And it's just this incredible, cavernous, kind of dark, very oppressive spaceship. Even though it's very big, it's not oppressive because it's small and claustrophobic. It's almost the opposite. It's too big for the small crew, and there's a fantastic, you know, it's working with sound very well, because there's kind of echoey, there's a lot of water dripping.
Yeah, I mean, it is a character as well.
Yeah,
the set designer. I mean, it was based on a famous artist called Geiger. His artwork, of course, is one of the key things in that film, isn't it, really? You know, the way the aliens look, and they, I think they have lots of statues and things, don't they? The kind of on the alien planet.
They do.
And it just looks incredible. And this is where, you know, art design, which most people don't really talk about when it comes to film making, is so important. Because, you know, I think that whole film is made because of the art design. You know, I don't rate Ridley Scott as a director. I don't think it's actually a well-directed film, personally. But I do think it looks... all of the sets look great. Because, you know, the art designer was really good. You know, the set designer did a really great job. And also, I mean, even if you think about the Alien films that followed, I still think, you know, Aliens and Alien 3 and even Alien 4, Alien Resurrection, you know, they are effective in their locations, I think. I mean, Alien 2 is very very effective. I mean, some of it's outside, as in the set, it's set outside, but I'm assuming that's still a set. And it still looks, they create a planet in Aliens, don't they, really, that looks, you know, we can believe. And Alien 3, I think, is also a great example of setting it in a prison. It's only set in a prison, in a very small location. And it looks great. And obviously, it's directed by a good director this time. So, it, you know, it's, I would say it's more thrilling than the first one. But anyway.
Well, that's an opinion that no one shares.
That's true. But that's fine. I mean, we're going to talk about the Alien films at one point anyway in the future. So we don't have to go down this road. So I think we should move on to the kind of nature. And of course, nature, I think most people are going to think of nature as being, you know, a film like Lord of the Rings, because that whole film, of course, was filmed in New Zealand on location. It looks amazing. You know,
they... And I would say the same thing you said about Alien is that I think the locations really make Lord of the Rings. One of the things I do think the casting was great, and many, many of the actors are just fantastic. I think the screenplays are quite good at, you know, adapting a very, very difficult work to adapt cinematically. But I also think, I mean, without those New Zealand locations, I don't think it would have been anywhere near as successful as it was. And I think for nature, because unlike sets, and even to a certain extent, unlike cities, where you still kind of choose where to film, well, maybe it is more like cities, you can say, okay, New Zealand is obviously beautiful, but you still have to, you know, to sort of storyboard the shots. The director of photography is really important here, and Andrew Lesney, who shot the Lord of the Rings films, was great at that, I think. Because after Lord of the Rings, almost all big fantasy films have been shot in New Zealand, and none of them look anywhere as good. I think there's... And there, you know, the same as with King Kong, we all think about, you know, the ape climbing the building. I think with Lord of the Rings... for me, one of the shots I always think about is, you know, in Fellowship of the Ring, which I think is the best film, when they kind of climb up to the crest of a mountain range, you know, and one by one, they kind of pass this, it's like an opening, and there's a rock, you know, and Gandalf leans on it, and then the others come, and then in the end, you have the silhouette, sort of the nine members of the Fellowship.
I don't remember that shot, to be honest with you at all. You know, I've only seen that film once, right?
And it was 20 years ago, right?
It was. But you know, funny enough, though, the one scene I remember the most, which is a nature scene, is obviously one of the most important scenes of the film, which is when Bilbo's getting attacked by the Dark Riders on the stream. Now, I remember that stream really well and the way it looks. And it's obviously a real stream, isn't it, in New Zealand? It's not CGI. Yes. It's not in a studio set. And I actually remember that scene, I think, more because that stream looks so real. You know, I think if it looked now, they'd probably just CGI it, and I think it would look worse, and I just don't think it would be as memorable. But it looks so beautiful, even though it's a kind of really scary moment in the film.
Yes, it's you've forgotten that it's Frodo, not Bilbo.
Sorry.
That's okay. But yes, it's him kind of running down that wooden pier and jumping out into the raft, right? And then the Black Rider, kind of coming swinging after him. At night, yes? Or is it when he's wading, or is it in the daylight?
I think it's in the daylight.
Ah, then it's wading. Okay, yeah, it's a bigger... Both of them are river scenes from Fellowship of the Ring. Yes, it's then when he's on... with Arwen, they're riding through it, and then the Black Riders come after them, and then there's... the river kind of gobbles them up. That actually is a CGI shot.
Oh, okay. But I assume the location isn't, though, right?
No, the location isn't. And yeah. I think your point absolutely stands, because I also think that's the strength of Lord of the Rings. When we start in the Shire, all of that is real. There's almost no CGI. I know they did build those kind of hobbit holes and little like the hobbit town, right? Hobbiton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is all. You're right. I think that that's so crucial to those films because, you know, of course, it's high fantasy. If you don't really buy it, then it doesn't work. And I think starting in this place where we have real big pigs, obviously, you know, these all of the hobbits, you know, there were people in dresses, you know, they did spend hours getting those hobbit feet applied. None of that is CGI.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's recognizable. It's kind of, there's an interesting point in Lord of the Rings criticism that they go seem to go back in history because the Shire is by far the most advanced society. You know, they have mills. It's kind of relatively late. And then they go back to something that's more Viking-like. And then they go back to something that's more Roman-like.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be going back into history. But we start with something that's kind of also very English, even though it's, you know, it's filmed in New Zealand, but it's recognizably English. And I think people can relate to that. And I think that's very important that we're on board with what is happening as real. And because we believe in the Shire, we can also believe in the Black Riders and the power of the ring. And I think that's an example of how this the location work was crucial to getting, kind of helping people, the viewers, into the story, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that whole kind of Englishness, because of course, yeah, I mean, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien himself was English, because, you know, I was thinking about, like, locations, because we don't really show English nature anymore, I would say, because as you said, now everything's filmed in New Zealand, mainly, or America, of course, because America...
Well, actually, London is filmed in Budapest. Well, maybe we should have mentioned that, why London does look like London. So many films
film
London in Budapest, because it's cheaper.
Well, Underworld is filmed in Budapest, and I think it looks great for it. It's not meant to be London, but I think it looks great because the first Underworld film does actually really establish this amazing fictional city, and it
that
actually...
That is a good point.
It looks great, you know, and then they kind of take the city out of the sequels, which is odd. I mean, the second one is not really set in a city at all, and it looks so
visually different. For it.
Yeah, it's odd, but no, just going back to the Englishness, I was just thinking there was some kind of shows that I remember watching as a kid that did use the kind of English nature. There was a show called, you know, The Chronicles of Narnia, which was a series which did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Prince Caspian, and The Silver Chair, and it was all filmed in England. And I think what's good about that series is that it shows the variety of the kind of English countryside, because we've got this really cool location, which is in Wiltshire, I think, which is kind of west of England. And it's where, like, Aslan is, and where his the stone table is and everything. And I actually went there a few years ago in real life. And it just looks so cool. Like, it's such a cool location. And then also, I was just telling Dimitri before we recorded this, there's a place off the coast of Cornwall called the Scilly Isles, which is an archipelago, however you say that word. And it has its own kind of temperature system, and it looks kind of tropical. It has got palm trees and things. And in the Chronicles of Narnia, in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, they go and they film there. And I remember as a kid always thinking, it looks like, you know, it looks like they've gone to the Caribbean or Spain or something. But it's actually just off the coast of England. And it's so bizarre because I don't think they'd film like that now. I think they would just fly to Spain, or they'd fly to the Caribbean, or they fly to, you know, the Middle East or something, or, you know, Tunisia or somewhere, just to go and film that. They would never go
Or just CGI the whole thing.
Or just CGI the whole thing. And also another show that I'd like to mention from the 90s, which Pride and Prejudice, of course, you know, the famous one, Colin Firth. You know, there's moments in that where, of course, they film with the real English old country houses, and also they film, you know, Derbyshire, and they film on the kind of countryside as well. And it looks, you know, it doesn't look as stunning as New Zealand, obviously, but it looks English. It looks very, you know, that we've got a lot to offer in this country, and I just don't think we don't make the most of it anymore, personally. Not that I'm trying to promote it or anything. I'm just saying, you know.
No, but why not? When so much of film, and especially television, that all the world watches still is English. You even made me think of something as simple, and yet I would say as successful, as The Vicar of Dibley.
Oh, yeah, you know,
which
of
is set in, like, a little English town. I'm sure it was filmed in a little English town, because, you know, I don't think they would... Why would they build sets for that? And it's just, like, you know, kind of English countryside with the sort of, you know, the rolling meadows and, like, little streams and you know, this nice kind of village church.
Mm-hmm.
It's very real, and it's, you know, it has a nice, this calm, pleasant atmosphere, which funnily enough, yes, I think is what the Shire is like, and, you know, something as dramatic as Lord of the Rings is that little corner of Englishness,
yes,
which is very reassuring. partly because we recognize it, of course, and but partly also because that is the strength of English nature, which, you know, so many authors have written about. It is much less dramatic than, you know, nature you can find in France or Italy or maybe even Germany. Mm. But it has that particular sort of sweet and homely and at the same time quite varied look.
Yes, yes. That just really randomly just made me think of District 9.
Hmm.
Because obviously that mixes city and nature kind of together, doesn't it? Because it's all set in Johannesburg, I think. Isn't it? Is it set in Johannesburg?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. It's one of the South African cities.
Yeah, and obviously that looks so different to other films because, you know, South Africa. I mean, there's a film called Chappie as well, it's directed by the same director. I can't remember.
Neil Blomkamp.
Yeah, yes. And it just looks very different. And I think this is why it's good that people do film in different locations now, that we have the access to do that. Of course, Star Wars, you know, we can talk about Star Wars for a long time, but Star Wars, of course, was filmed, all the outdoor stuff with Luke's planet, I think was filmed in Tunisia.
And most of it was actually filmed in England on Shepperton Studios, I think.
There you go. So a mix, once again, a mix of these kind of fake sets and real locations. But Star Wars, I mean, you know, the fact that you could go to Tunisia then and film it gives it that very distinctive look. And I think this is why we really need to kind of continue to film in really awesome locations instead of just the same thing, places. And I think that's why sometimes, you know, just watching American shows that are set in LA or New York, you know, I can understand the reason why, because it's cost effective. And also, you know, they're kind of big cities that people recognize and people are based in. But, you know, sometimes there's a really good reason to film in other locations. And I think that's why one of the reasons we love Legend of the Seeker so much, right? Because that's filmed in New Zealand. And, you know, you mentioned before that not many places that have come after after Lord of the Rings have done New Zealand justice. I definitely think Legend of the Seeker does New Zealand justice.
Agreed.
Because it still looks wonderful. But also...
And it looks different.
It looks different.
I actually think it looks different to Lord of the Rings.
I was going
to
say, it looks like a different world. It's not, you know... whatever the world, Middle Earth. It's not Middle Earth. It's definitely the sequel.
And it's like, I guess, you know, also like, you know, beautiful New Zealand and of course a good location managing, because it looks far less dramatic. You know, it has a lot of these woods that are quite light, you know, with sort of sunlight streaming in through the crowns of the trees, whereas in Lord of the Rings, the forests are really heavy and dark mostly. So that's another job, you know. Location manager is a very important job.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, you have to do it well.
I have to tell you, when you're filming on location with a big crew, it is hell. It's not easy, okay? It's really difficult.
I mean, I guess this is why, as an audience, I think usually watching something shot on location is preferable, but for the filmmakers, the crew, I'm sure working in the studio is much, much simpler, isn't
100%.
It?
Because, well, once again, we talked about England raining and the temperamental weather. In a studio, you can control the lighting, you can control the rain. You know, it's not going to be rain unless you want it to be raining, like, you know, fake rain. Whereas, you know, that's, once again, one of the reasons why they film everything in LA is because the weather is very... very samey all the time, and the sun is so bright, you're going to get good light, so it looks good, you know, on film. It looks great, you know, because you get bright light, it comes through the camera, it looks nice. Whereas, you know, realistically, we know in England, you know, you're going to get about 3 days of the year where you get a bright day. The rest of the time it's going to be gray and miserable, raining. And, you know, also New Zealand, of course, you know, I haven't been there, I know that they do have rain and stuff, but of course the weather, you know, they have summer, and I think they have a more regular summer than we do. So, you know, that's just, it just makes sense. One thing, let's end on, because we need to wrap this up now. One thing that really irritates me about kind of watching the made-for-TV Christmas movies, which I, of course, secretly enjoy, as we've discussed in our Christmas episode.
Not so secretly, I think.
Exactly. Is when they are obviously filmed in LA, whenever they have snowy scenes, it's... So one of the tricks of the trade is that fake snow is actually... foam bubbles, so it's like washing up bubbles basically. But what if you know this, when you look, you can see it's all just bubbles falling on the floor and on the actors' faces and on the actors' clothes, so you can see just clumps of bubbles everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks terrible if you know that trick. You just look out for it and you're like, oh my gosh, this is really bad, because you can see bubbles all over the place.
That is so interesting. But it does look, snow in these American Christmas films always does look fake, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why, because it's all bubbles. So they're not
interesting.
Actually,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Next time you watch
now, Jonathan has ruined Christmas films
for
all of us.
I've ruined Christmas films for everyone. I'm so sorry, but In all fairness, it's funny because sometimes you have the actors have like, they have bubbles on their kind of eyelashes or something. And you can see it's a clump of bubbles. And I'm just like...
And it never melts.
No,
right?
It doesn't melt. And you're just like, why has no one noticed this? Someone in the, you know, continuity department should have been like, wipe the bubbles away from their face. So anyway.
The time has come for us to wrap this up, hasn't it, Jonathan? I think this has been a very, very interesting episode.
Yes. And to big up the people that do work that you might not even think about, because I think, you know, a lot of the time we just talk about directors and actors, but, you know, we should be thinking about all the other people that do loads of other jobs that are equally as important to the film.
Yep, filmmaking sure is a team effort, and I wonder if that isn't part of the reason why films have gone downhill, as we believe, because everyone's an egotist now, right? I think teamwork just has a bad name.
Yes, of course, but...
in the among people working in the media.
Well, I would know that, but that's another story.
I'd love to get to that story at some point. But it will have to wait a little while, because with this episode, we are rounding out our third season. And
yeah, it's been a good season. We've had a lot of variety. We've had a lot of fun, and we've talked about a lot of, you know, completely different things. I think it's been really good. And also we've had, you know, a lot of listens and a lot of comments on social media. So that's been really positive as well. So it's good to know that you're all out there. And, you know, I'd just like to say thank you for listening and staying with us, because, you know, it's been a good three seasons, hasn't it, Dimitri?
It's been a year pretty exactly, I think, from when we first started releasing. Thank you indeed. You have now something like 35 episodes to listen to. If you haven't heard them all, you're very welcome to go back. We don't really do topical episodes mostly, so they're still hopefully relevant. We talk about films that are 50 years old, so what's another year?
Exactly.
We will be active on social media throughout our coming hiatus from recording, especially on Twitter, I think, at Screen of C.
And you're always out there on the Instagram, aren't you?
I am on the Instagram as well, at SFC Podcast, and on Facebook as well. So please do get in touch. On Twitter, we've gone into the habit of doing interesting film polls. The most recent one about who is the main character in Terminator 2, as promised in our previous episode. We did the poll. Very interesting results. It was a close run. We're going to do more things like that. So
we'll be
engage
there.
Engage with us.
Exactly. Even if we don't release the episodes, we'll still be there. But we'll definitely be coming back, you know, later this year, with some, you know, new episodes. So, you know, tune in then. It's going to be great, and it's going to be exciting. We've got some great ideas already, haven't we, for what we're going to do, what we're going to talk about.
We have new great ideas and great old ideas. I'm certainly gearing up for another Halloween special.
Exactly. Until then, good luck, goodbye, and have a great time until we're back.
Have a lovely summer. Stay safe. Get the shot if you want to. Don't get it if you don't. And hopefully we can all go traveling and be going to the cinema much more often. And then on this episode, on this podcast, we can actually start doing episodes about current films, which we can watch simultaneously in different countries, which has been a challenge.
Well, fingers crossed, I would like to go and watch the new James Bond film. So maybe we could do an episode on that if we actually allowed to go see it. If it ever comes out.
We should do that. Yes, that's a promise. Actually talk about the new James Bond film if it comes out this year.
If it ever comes out this year, exactly. But no, thank you so much, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.